I'll say this. I just start covering the team. Like, when she arrived, Oregon women's basketball was not a sports that that territory really covered. We didn't pay much attention to them. We would follow their NCAA tournament runs if they had them. Of course, up to that point, they hadn't had Andrew Paul Westhead. And things changed drastically rather quickly, whereby her sophomore season, they're suddenly focusing a lot of attention on women's basketball. That's something that we hadn't done previously. And I can say that it wasn't just myself that was paying attention. It wasn't just you that was paying attention. Other folks, like, I would receive text messages from people who were ecstatic about women's basketball throughout both the 2018-19 and 2019-20 season. And I can say, like, I wasn't covering the team before. I didn't get any text messages about women's basketball at Oregon for years of covering, you know, University of Oregon athletics. So, yeah, I think it's huge. And like I said, like, there just wasn't that much interest in women's basketball to begin. I mean, there was certainly, you know, I was growing up doing Eugene under Beth Smith. There were some pretty good teams, and there were some pretty good teams under Jody Runge, but there was never anything quite like this. And certainly before the last couple of years, nothing even close to it. So I think, yeah, it's a great way of, I think, establishing just the legacy that she was able to build here, because we weren't covering her. Not a lot of people were covering that program when she arrived. And by the time she left, I'll tell you, the press box was full all the time. There were times where we had diminished numbers of writers available to cover games just because there was such demand.
Yeah, it was amazing to just to watch her grow it. And, you know, there are obviously other factors. But I want to get to some football, because I've been here 30 years. Recruiting's always been interesting, you know, as the program grew, whether it's better facilities. And then, you know, Willie Taggart came here and felt like, you can recruit the Ducks. This is a national brand. As wired in as you are, how impressed should we be with what Coach Cristobal and his staff have done, just luring the kind of talent that they have to Eugene?
I think you give me some easy questions to start here, Steve. I think, like, all of the impressed, you know, like, as much as you can, the full meter. And this is unparalleled. And really, Oregon currently is fifth nationally in the 247 sports recruiting composite rankings. The best they've ever finished was seventh, and that was under Mark Cristobal in his first full recruiting class a couple of years ago. Last year's class had 3 5-star recruits. This year's class, in 2021, on paper, looks like it's going to be pretty undeniably the best class Oregon has ever had. And at 24/7 Sports, we just had one of our national recruiting writers, Steve Wolf, calling on Tuesday, right? Basically, that Oregon is entering itself into the legitimately as a candidate to finish with the number one overall recruiting class on this cycle. I was going through the numbers. I think it's a little far-fetched to expect to get to number one, but 2, 3, 4 nationally? I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility for where they finish this year. And considering that Oregon had never had a single top 10 recruiting class before Mario Cristobal took over, that tells you basically all you need to know about what's going on. I mean, they're going to basically put together 3 straight cycles, this first 3 full cycles as the head football coach at Oregon, that are better than any cycle prior to his arrival. So, I mean, technology is basically all you need to know. It's working right now.
Remarkable seems to be a word that comes to mind. Talking with Eric Scopel, Duck Territory, you posted a story about defensive coordinator Andy Avalos and how players take different paths or a different amount of time, in essence, before the light goes on. And in essence, they become the best version of themselves. I looked at Kayvon Thibodeau, game one through the Rose Bowl, kind of a wow. What did Coach have to say about his transformation and kind of the moments that stuck out during his true freshman season?
And I want to start by just giving credit to Rob Mosley from RedHawks.com for conducting great interviews with Oregon coaches and athletes while we're in this pandemic and we're kind of limited access. He spoke with Andy Avalos last Thursday for almost 40 minutes. The quote that what you're talking about was said during the interview. So I'm going to at least give some context to the listeners.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Right? And it's probably worth those listening to go watch the full almost 40 minutes, the great interview. But yeah, I think, you know, he used both Kayvon Thibodeau and Popo Amabe as two players who, through the course, we should say both defensive linemen, both very good defensive linemen for Oregon, that over the course of last season made huge in-season progress. And it was a matter of, he used the example for Popo Amabe, the Stanford game was a game where he knew Popo was going to need to play a little bit more, and they hyped him up throughout the week, and he went out and performed at a really high level, and that was a turning point, because Popo was able to see from day one of the Stanford week of what it takes to prepare to get to this level. He was then able to see in the game itself what it feels like to make those plays and contributions, and then in reflection over the film review to be able to go, hey, these are the things I'm doing that worked. These are things that I can still improve on, that I can continue to let me kind of have these feelings, these moments. And I think that's kind of what he was establishing, is like, it's one thing to do it in practice, it's another thing to go out and accomplish it on the field. And when you do accomplish some stuff on the field, and a player like Kayvon obviously accomplished a lot on the field, that confidence and understanding of what it takes to get there and do everything the right way is a really important lesson for young players to learn. So, I think Andy Avalos is a great defensive coordinator. A lot of the stuff he says, I think, just makes so much sense. So I would recommend those listening, go listen to that full conversation. Certainly go read that story and a couple of others I've had up on DuckTerritory.com over the last week that have kind of recapped a lot of what Andy Avalos had to say.
You know, along those lines, last year leading up, I guess the most exposed, most talked about unit was the offensive line. This year, I'm sure you're going to see a lot of previews talking about the secondary. But, you know, you mentioned Amave and Thibodeau, Jordan Scott. I think accurate to say the potential of the defensive front is pretty high, too, just not getting as much publicity right now.
It's high. It's not quite secondary high, I don't think. It's definitely higher than I think what the linebacker group can get. Even the linebackers have all those five-star recruits. There's a lot of youth to work on there. You look at the defensive line, bring back two seniors who have a decent amount of starting experience. Jordan Scott has like 35 career starts. I think he's second on the whole team behind Thomas Graham in returning starts. And then Austin Folliu, another player with about a little over a dozen starts. So you got those two players as seniors. You got Kayvon at end, and we all know what he can do. His ceiling is really high, and I'm not going to be stunned at all if he ends up breaking some significant school records for tackles for long sacks. Maybe not next season, but over the course of his time at Oregon. And then a player like Popo. Those are four really, really good defensive linemen, and I think the key for Joe Salovea on that defensive line is finding, you know, three to four more guys. And I think that's, if there is a concern, it's just where does the depth come from? There's a lot of bodies. I think they added five interior or quasi-interior defensive linemen in the 2019 class. We didn't see a ton of contributions from those guys last year. I'm not including Kayvon in that group, but like Brandon Dorlis played. He's the only one that didn't burn a red shirt here. The others are all uses a redshirt year, and I think that group, those kind of five guys, are going to be integral to seeing what this line group can be, because I think the top end's really good, but they still need to find a couple of depth pieces. And I think they're there. I think Brandon Dorlis is good. I know Keon Ware Hudson's a player I've heard a lot of positive things about, same with Suavi Poti, but just haven't yet seen it on the field from those guys quite yet.
All right, we often hear about the rooms in football, the secondary room, and prior to a couple months ago, if you looked at Oregon's quarterback room, whether it be Tyler Shuck, Jay Butterfield, Cale Millen, the word was talented but not a lot of experience. So they bring in a guy with a lot of experience in Anthony Brown from Boston College. Some were looking at it like, well, what does this mean? And accurate to say, it meant that you got a guy with some experience, and all it means is the level of competition rose.
Absolutely. And I think there was some questions about why does Oregon go add an Anthony Brown when they have a Tyler Shuck, who we should say looks great in the first spring practices. By all accounts, the coaches were really impressed with his work this spring. There have been numerous quotes from both Cristobal and Moorhead where they both basically said, like, he entered the spring as a starter, he left it as a starter. And yet they go and they take Anthony Brown, right? It's kind of interesting. But I was saying this even before they added Brown. I think the reality you have to recognize is rewind the clock, 3 years, and think back to when Justin Herbert was playing under Willie Taggart, and he gets hurt diving in the end zone against California, and they have to replace him with somebody who has no college experience, and it's a true freshman quarterback in Braxton Burmeister. Well, if Oregon didn't go out and add Anthony Brown, who do they hand the reins off if something happens to Tyler Shuck? Is it a Cale Millen, who's a redshirt freshman? Is it a Jay Butterfield or a Robbie Ashford, true freshman? Regardless of what the choice is, it's somebody with zero game experience. So I think it made some sense to do that. I also think it makes some sense to challenge Tyler Shuck. I'm not saying that the quarterbacks that were already on the roster couldn't do that, but it was pretty clear who the quarterback was, and you bring in an Anthony Brown, at least you make Tyler Shuck sweat, and who knows, maybe Brown's good enough that either is the starting quarterback, or at least he factors into some stuff. I wouldn't be stunned to see Joe Moorhead is known for being pretty innovative with his offenses. Maybe they try to use two quarterbacks at times. Maybe they give Brown a series here or there where he's where he's running the offense. I don't know, but at least you have flexibility now with some experience. And again, worst-case scenario where Shuck goes down with an injury, if he does win the job, at least you have a quarterback you can rely upon to throw in there.
No, I felt it was a move made from strength. I'm talking with Eric Scopel, Duck Territory. Let's get to hoops. I love the decade retrospective. You wrote about the guards, and I like, you know, just the guards. No, didn't specify point or two. And, you know, seeing guys like Devo Joseph, Dylan Ennis, Tyler Dorsey. So you narrowed it down. Who are your final two guards as the top Ducks of the decade? And why did it come down to those two?
Well, it was pretty easy to break it down to the two, I think. And that's Peyton Pritchard and Joseph Young. And I gave Pritchard the nod over Young. Both players went on Big 12 Player of the Year in their final seasons at Oregon. I just think Pritchard's career is a little bit more outstanding as a whole than Young. If you think about where he finishes as a four-year player, the all-time winningest player at Oregon. I think he was the first unanimous All-American this last year in like 80 years. Joseph Young was a tremendous scorer and a great player, but I also think you look at the two teams he played on, the furthest they made in the tournament was the second round, or the round of 32. You can look at Pritchard and say, well, he made the Final Four as a freshman. It wasn't his team. His junior year, they made a Sweet 16 run, and he was a huge part of that. And it's honestly his senior season, and I've said this a couple times, like, this is like that could have been a Kemba Walker kind of thing for Peyton Pritchard, where he's just the best player on the court. Maybe the team's not the most talented, but they could really compete. Obviously, that never materialized because the tournament gets canceled, but I just think Pritchard kind of puts it all together as a winner, as a strong individual offensive player, and really as a good all-around offensive and defensive player by the time he was a senior.
And he also owns the city of Seattle, which is key. couple final thoughts for Eric. The wing players, in many ways, a staple of the Ernie Ken era. I had a Lewis King sighting. I always wonder what another year here would have done for him. You had a current guy, Chris Duarte, the Oregon connection, and E.J. Singler. And then your final two, and as you wrote, one might be obvious, but two was kind of an interesting call. So who'd you have?
All right, yeah. Well, number one is Dylan Brooks. I don't think there's going to be much resistance from those listening to that choice. But number two was Elgin Cook. And, you know, I think I look back at Elgin Cook, and I kind of wanted to put him higher, even though I could. I was a huge fan of what he did on the court. He's an absolute bulldog, great defensive player. I could get to the rim, it seemed like, whenever he wanted to. Just didn't have a jump shot, and that's the thing that separated him from someone like Brooks or you know, some of those kind of players at Oregon, because he just could shoot the basketball. But I loved watching Elgin Cook play, and I loved watching Dylan Brooks play, too. So, it was, you know, Brooks was an easy choice at the top just because he was the player of the year. He had some huge shots. You know, I would say he was kind of the house of dogs on probably the two best Oregon teams ever. Made the Final Four in the Elite Eight in consecutive years. But Cook was certainly a deserving number two. And really the one that surprised me when I was putting that list together was E.J. Singler. I wasn't expecting to have him at number three, but I just thought Singler's career in retrospect is really, really impressive and was really a key component to Dan Altman's kind of first 3 years there, getting things turned around, getting to a Sweet 16.
No, and it was a great recent trip down memory lane. And finally, the bigs. And again, as the program grew under Ernie Kent, the two Elite Eights, that position was more serviceable. And, you know, first of all, just to remember, Olu Ashalu was worth the price of admission. You know, Arsalan Kazemi was awesome to kind of reminisce about. So who was your top duet of big fellas?
Well, these two are pretty easy picks, I thought. And they played together, and that was Jordan Bell and Chris Boucher at Bell number one and Boucher number two. And honestly, you probably could make an argument for Boucher over Bell, but I think what Bell did in the NCAA tournament there, blocking eight shots against Kansas, that's still a school record in the tournament, and just his overall tournament, the way he played in that tournament to get them to a Final Four, was kind of what distinguished the two of them. But both, I think, will obviously be remembered together. Dynamic shot blocking duo. They're 1-2 all time at Oregon in shot blocks. Boucher's having a tremendous NBA career. I didn't really take that into consideration. But Oregon's had some great bigs. I think if you look at the list, your top five bigs from the last decade is probably better than your top five guards or your top five wings. And like you said, I think that says a lot considering that under Ernie Kent, like, I don't know who the best big under Ernie Kent was if we were doing it from like 2000 to 2009, but I'm going to guess they probably don't rank much higher than like sixth or seventh on the list this last decade.
No, no question about it. Kris Kristofferson or somebody like that.
Ian Crosswhite?
Crosswhite, maybe. I always say that there was never a guy that big who finished worse at the rim. But I don't want to end up...
Important distinction.
Folks, he's Eric Scopel. Scopes, great stuff as always. Follow along with him. Duck Territory 24/7 Sports. The Twitter handle is @Eric_Scopel. Eric, always appreciate your time and insight. Great catching up. And I hope we could talk soon about, you know, like actual sports. But thanks for your time.
Thanks, Steve. Let's do it when there's real sports to talk about, whether that's even or Matt goes in.
Right. Have a good one, Eric. Appreciate it, man.
You too.
Take it easy.